Thank you for downloading this podcast from File on 4. In this edition, Jackie Long asks how far we can rely on memory when dealing with allegations of sexual abuse that may go back decades. For full terms and conditions, go to bbc.co.uk/podcasts.
When memory is your only evidence, can justice ever be done? Allegations of sexual abuse against children are among the most sensitive and difficult cases the legal system has to deal with, often relying on one person's word against another. But when those allegations go back decades, each person's testimony is reliant on their memory. Now, with a raft of historical abuse cases continually going through the courts, there's concern within the criminal justice system that innocent people are going to jail.
There is a new genre of miscarriages of justice in this country, and they're historic allegations, and they destroy lives. And we're now in a situation where the court, at its peril, is ignoring the issue about the reliability of memories, and the situation being that juries will convict in circumstances where it would be unsafe to do so.
Tonight, we ask, can memory science provide any answers? How much can it tell us about the way memory works? As the Law Commission urges caution over the use of expert witnesses, how can juries ever decide whose story is true?
What he told me as a little girl was that people would not believe what I said and that they would believe him. And that's what panned out. When he said they wouldn't believe me, he was right. They don't.
It was absolutely wonderful to walk outside and see some sort of distance instead of tall walls, to see people walking about and to be able to walk across a zebra crossing to get in a taxi and travel to the railway station to go home.
Frank Joynson had served the first 12 months of a 13-year sentence for serious sexual assault against five young boys when his conviction was quashed in the Court of Appeal in 2008. The allegations had first surfaced 2 years earlier. Mr. Joynson, who'd worked looking after children in care for 40 years, was told one morning the police were waiting to see him.
I was told that there was two police officers at the reception room wishing to speak to me, and I entered the reception room. They confirmed who I was and said, there's been allegations against you and we're arresting you, and they read me my rights. Took me across to find where my car was to search that. And then they took me to my house and did the same.
What was going through your mind at this stage? The police officers arrive and they're looking for you.
I was totally in shock. They did mention the school that I'd worked at, where the allegations supposedly came from, but I left that school in December 1971 and I had no contact with it at all. It was in my past, and when they mentioned the school, I was totally shocked.
The initial allegation came from one boy who'd been at the school 35 years earlier. But as the police investigation continued, others came forward too. Mark Newby is Mr. Joynson's solicitor.
I think there's always a danger that once you have more than a couple of complainants, the Crown will often pursue the matter because it then becomes prosecution by numbers. Because the Crown will feel safe that it's got a reasonable prospect of securing a conviction, which is its ultimate test for prosecution. Frank Joynson's case was a particularly concerning case. Mr. Joynson spent 40 years, unblemished career, working in the care industry. All his past work colleagues were prepared to come and stand up and say there was no question in their mind of him ever being involved in these sort of offences.
As he sat in the dock and listened to two of his accusers, now men in their 50s, Mr. Joynson said their seeming recall of events was so clear, they made compelling witnesses.
Both boys, actually, the supposedly buggered by me, went into great detail about the position that he was in, how I approached them, why he was in that position up in the bedrooms. A great amount of detail, that there was blood all over his sheets and so forth. But the detail made it more believable. In the witness box, sounded very sort of lucid and precise.
And that's why he felt from the very beginning of the trial that despite his innocence, he would be convicted.
The thing is, you're dealing with such an emotional issue that you know that you're going to be in the hands of a jury. And obviously, when the accusers go into the witness box, it sounds terrible. I mean, it really does sound terrible when they relate the stories.
How difficult was it listening to their story of that event, though, and the fact that they were saying that's what you'd done to them?
Immensely difficult, because you know as a person, it's not me. It never has been, never will be. They're portraying me as something that I know I'm not. But you look across to the jury and you suddenly realise, but they don't know me. They don't know me from Adam. If them 12 jury members were my ex-colleagues, I'd have no problems.
Frank Joynson's instinct turned out to be right. He was found guilty of 2 counts of serious sexual assault and 12 of indecent assault.
My stomach just dropped and my body just sagged, really, because I knew the finality of it.
And the fact you were innocent?
You basically want to scream out that it's wrong. You know, you've made a mistake. But, you know, it's to no avail. The decision's made and that's the end.
In fact, it wasn't quite the end. His solicitor, Mark Newby, took the case to appeal. Critical to their argument was the fact that over time, documents including social services reports and staff records had disappeared, leaving the case to turn on memories and little else.
The Court of Appeal was very strong and clear that it was very concerned about the Frank Joynson case. One complainant maintained that Mr. Joynson had had him sit on his knee, and at that point he'd been abused. His mother, in statements to the police, had indicated, in fact, that that wasn't what he'd said, that, in fact, he'd said a former teacher who was convicted some years previously, it was him. And so, of course, the Court of Appeal felt that where there were real questions over the reliability of memory, clearly, by reference to the documents, that would have assisted the jury in answering the matter one way or the other.
So what does, for you, the case tell us about this whole very, very difficult area of historical allegations of sexual abuse?
Any allegation of abuse could very properly be true. But what we need to do is to test those allegations very carefully. That we mustn't just assume guilt because a person faces a number of allegations. That we must look for the supporting evidence. And that we must challenge memory because memory may not be reliable. At the end of the day, it's just like playing Russian roulette with people's lives. There are cases where if the allegations are specific enough and those records clearly aren't available, then in those cases they shouldn't proceed. And too infrequently still, despite the Court of Appeal decisions, the Crown Courts are still not prepared to stop those cases.
But stopping those cases, what does that say about the rights of people who are alleging that they have suffered terrible abuse and they want justice?
The people that obviously have cases stopped will feel aggrieved at the system and feel let down. But one should never forget those people now who currently may be sitting in prison cells who shouldn't be there because their cases should have been stopped. There's always a balance in the criminal justice system, but we have to try and make sure that's a fair balance.
We hope to talk to the Crown Prosecution Service about how they assess whether or not to bring such cases to court. They declined to be interviewed but did issue a statement which said each case is thoroughly reviewed on its own merits, and went on.
Proceeding with a prosecution based solely on the word of the complainant presents particular challenges, regardless of when the offending occurred. In all cases, and especially where there has been a significant delay in reporting, prosecutors make sure they do not allow a prosecution where it would be seen as oppressive or unfair and amount to an abuse of process of the court.
We've been looking for official figures to get some sense of how many historical abuse cases are going through the courts, but it appears that no one's counting. We did ask the Crown Prosecution Service, but they said there's no specific classification of historic sexual abuse. They would be categorised according to offence, for example, rape or indecent assault, but without reference to when the offence is said to have taken place. Now, does that matter? Well, according to those campaigning for change, it does.
The damage to people wrongly convicted is great because, of course, the stain of a sexual allegation never escapes them.
Mark Newby, Frank Joynson's solicitor, believes until figures are collated, the authorities have no understanding how significant this issue is.
We can only achieve a notional assessment of the scale of the problem, but we look at many, many appeal cases. We have several hundred cases on our books at the moment. I'm sure there are many other lawyers who specialise in appeals in a similar position, and there's clearly a significant problem here, and it's one that needs to be addressed.
But if the figures are not being collected, it's not because the authorities haven't been told about the problems in this area, according to former MP Claire Curtis-Thomas. She was a member of the influential Home Affairs Select Committee in 2002, which looked into the way investigations into abuse in care homes were handled. Its report was highly critical, calling for special safeguards for trials in all historical child abuse cases because of the prejudicial nature of the offences and the serious evidential difficulties. She believes the issue is not being addressed and that justice is falling victim to political expediency.
People must be under no illusion. These are conscience cases. We are all concerned about the fact that we've left children in care homes for years without taking any action against people who perpetrated abuse against them. So we now have conscience cases that are being prosecuted in the court, and therefore there's a predisposition by juries, in fact, to believe this evidence despite any objective counter-arguments that there might be.
As chair of the All-Party Group on Abuse Investigations, she says she repeatedly took her concerns to the heart of government.
I've been and visited every Home Secretary whilst I was in Parliament, and the same is true with all the Attorney Generals and with the Solicitor Generals. The response from all of them was pretty much the same. Yes, you know, your concerns are commendable, but we're not going to act on this because we believe the system as it's set out is fair. After all, juries hear the evidence and therefore they convict people on the evidence that they hear. But I was told by one Home Secretary, he was far more candid than that, and he just said, you know, Claire, are you suggesting that we somehow now review the rules and the procedures which have led to the conviction of these sex offenders? What would that give us? What that would probably give us is sex offenders' convictions being overturned. We are not going to go forward with legislation or reviews which allow convicted sex offenders back out on the streets.
We asked the Ministry of Justice for an interview, but they too declined. In their statement, they said, if there isn't sufficient evidence to prove the alleged offence, a case wouldn't proceed. And the statement went on.
There are also other important safeguards in the criminal justice system against the conviction of the innocent, including the high standard of proof, whereby the prosecution has to prove its case beyond reasonable doubt, the right to legal representation, the right to call any witnesses, and the right to challenge and test evidence through cross-examination. There is no general requirement for corroboration evidence. Where evidence involves recollection from some years in the past, it is a matter for the jury to determine its reliability after the defence has had the opportunity to test it during cross-examination.
So when cases are brought when there's little or no corroboration, centred instead on memory evidence, how able are juries to deal with those challenges? This is Preston Crown Court, an imposing red brick building in the centre of the city. Now, it was here in the summer of 2009. The jury was asked to hear evidence for an extraordinary story. At its heart, the issue of memory and how reliable it can be when recollecting events which took place two decades ago. The case revolved around two brothers whose memories of being abused when they were 6 and 8 suddenly came to light in the most unusual of circumstances. All the jury had to go on was their word against that of the accused.
What was significant about this particular case was that these two boys, now in their 20s, had apparently, quite independently, simultaneously recalled the abuse in a sudden and complete way.
Sarah Booth is the barrister who defended the man accused of the abuse.
One of the brothers was serving in the armed forces. His recollection was that he was doing something as mundane as polishing his shoes, when out of the blue, he received a flash of memory. He then relayed that to his mother. His younger brother had the previous evening spoken to her. Almost the same circumstances had been recalled by him.
Literally within hours,
yes.
These two men remembered abuse that they had never spoken about to each other or anyone else.
And they were adamant during the trial that they had never spoken to each other about this abuse at any time. In fact, when asked the question, if you'd been asked in your teenage years, if you'd been the victim of abuse, what would the answer be? They said no, they had absolutely no recollection or knowledge of this abuse until they both experienced what they recall and describe as a flashback when they were in their mid-20s.
So, the court was left with two versions of events, conflicting sets of memories of incidents which had or hadn't taken place 2 decades ago. Because of the unusual way the two complainants had recalled those events, expert witnesses were called in by both sides, psychologists specialising in memory science, to evaluate the brothers' memories.
These witnesses gave compelling accounts of what they believed to be the abuse they had suffered. Both brothers claimed that they could recall exact conversations, not just with the defendant, but with their family members around the time. The general consensus is that recall of exact verbatim conversations is simply not possible. People will remember the gist of what was said, but not the exact words. And although it may seem to the jury that remembering spoken words and thoughts add credence to a story, in actual fact, as far as the experts are concerned, it makes the memory less likely to be true.
In this case, the jury was unable to reach a verdict and so had to be discharged. The Crown Prosecution Service decided not to order a retrial and the judge found the defendant not guilty. For Sarah Booth, though, serious questions remain.
In my experience, allegations of historic sexual abuse are finding their way to the courts more and more. And because of that, there is a need to consider the memory of those making the allegations. Because complainants are talking about instances that happened, in some cases, decades previously, their memory, their ability to recall what actually happened, is a very real issue.
Because in your experience, a compelling witness may not always be an accurate one.
A compelling witness often can be a mistaken witness. And the memory itself is malleable and it is fallible. And of course, there are many other exterior influences on a person that can mean that they genuinely believe what they are saying to be the truth. And later that can be found to be completely untrue.
So what do we know about memory? What does the science actually tell us about how reliable it is? I went to the University of Leeds to meet memory expert Professor Martin Conway and his team. He was one of the authors of Memory and the Law, a guidebook published by the British Psychological Society. He's also much in demand as an expert witness in historical abuse cases. Before I talked to him, I had my memory put to the test.
OK, Jackie, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to run through 6 word lists with you. And what I want you to do is to try to memorise the words.
So I just wait, I listen to them.
And then write them down.
OK.
OK, so here we have list 1. Table. Sit. Legs. Seat.
Senior lecturer guest, Katrina Morrison, recliner, guides me through a well-known memory experiment.
Cushion, rocking. Bench. OK. Try and recall as many of those words as possible.
This doesn't feel like it's going very well, actually. I'm stuck, yeah.
Yep. That's
one,
fine.
2, 3, 4, 5.
Yep,
five.
That's fairly typical. So list 2. Hill, valley, climb.
For part 2, we move into the lecture theatre to join psychology students who've also been doing the test. We're all asked to study a written list of words and decide which ones we remember as having been read to us earlier.
Bench was, candle wasn't, and chair wasn't.
Are you surprised?
Some of them, yes.
As you're probably aware now, there was a misleading word that you never saw, but which was highly related to some of the words you did see. How many really strongly felt that chair was on the list?
Yeah. Everybody.
Did you remember something to do with it? Did you think, oh, yes, chair, I remember thinking chair, or I had an image of chair?
Yes, I just remember just being sat on it.
Sure. So easy to remember.
But what's really interesting about all of this, of course, is that chair wasn't on the original list, so you couldn't have seen it and you couldn't have had those thoughts. How about you, Jack?
Well, I was probably certain that it had been on the list.
Even though it is a bit of a trick, it's a very simple demonstration that a person can be easily, not only misled, but led to the point where they really actually experience an item as having been seen before when it wasn't.
Back in the professor's office, I ask him to explain how he thinks the result of this experiment is played out in the courts in the historical abuse cases in which he regularly gives evidence.
The reliability of memory is a particularly thorny issue. Memory's been studied for many, many decades, and we do understand really quite a lot about it now, and it doesn't fit with common beliefs about memory. Essentially, your brain fills in things for you, and it doesn't tell you, it just does it. And when it does it, you just experience it. There's no question about thinking, was this one of the words in the earlier list? You just experience that as a memory. Your brain fills it in for you. We're talking about a kind of device, the brain, that's more concerned with making sense of things than it is in representing them accurately. Memories virtually always contain information that we don't really remember, and it is something that the law has yet to really come to terms with, and many cases going through our courts very often depend solely on somebody's memory, specific details from an event. The science of memory tells us that that's almost like gambling.
Professor Conway says one of the biggest dangers is that people on juries can be convinced by what's known as trivial persuasion, the idea that the more detailed a memory, the more reliable. Something he says is simply not true.
These cases going through our courts where adults remember events from very early in childhood, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years of age. People remember the clothes that other people wore. They remember the colour of the curtains, what the wallpaper design was, where the furniture was positioned in the room, what the weather was like, where other people were in the house. And from my perspective as a memory researcher, that is clearly impossible. Here's a memory remembered by a 35-year-old from when they were supposedly aged 4 years. And it's a memory which is more detailed than any memory I've ever seen in an adult. You know, that starts to ring alarm bells, basically. On the other hand, these are the exact sorts of memories. I don't know how to put this without being too pointed, but those are the exact sorts of memories that people are easily convinced by.
What, in your view, has happened?
I believe that what happens very often in these cases is that the adult remembers only a few often distorted fragments of the abuse. And in their own mind, they build around that a kind of sophisticated adult elaboration in which pieces of information have been added in later on. But they might have been added in for very valid reasons, and that is the person wants to be believed.
I mean, are you saying that because of everything you said about memory, that actually none of these cases should ever be brought?
Well, that's a much more difficult issue, and the law is very clear about this, and that is if the only evidence that's available is someone's memory, that's fine.
But aren't you saying that, in essence, that memory is unreliable? And if it's the sole piece of evidence?
Well, I think I probably am. I think there are problems with people who are making the decisions to prosecute. I think they have rather naive theories of memory themselves.
But even among the scientists, what is accepted about memory is not definitive. Many aspects of it are clearly subject to different interpretations. Professor Chris Bruin is a clinical psychologist at the University College London. His research focuses on how memory for traumatic events differs from normal memory.
Memory is, on the whole, fairly reliable. Otherwise, it wouldn't be much use to us. But that said, psychologists have been really sometimes quite obsessed by ways in which memory can let us down and by errors and biases that may be in memory. The vast majority of memory research actually doesn't fit very well with everyday life. It's only comparatively recently that we've started looking at what we call autobiographical memory. That's people's memory for their own personal experience. And of course, that's much more complicated and it's much harder to study. And you can't introduce the same sorts of experimental controls that you can with word lists.
Now, I did one of those word list experiments, and myself and a number of postgrads, a number of students, were, if you like, caught out. We remembered words that hadn't been in the word list. Now, what does that prove?
It proves that under normal conditions, people often make assumptions about what they've seen, and they are affected by pre-existing associations that they have in their mind, such as the connections between different sorts of words. But whether you can generalize from that to say that people might, for example, make up events which hadn't happened is highly controversial. And certainly the people who invented this particular experimental technique have cautioned against assuming that it can be simply translated into real-world experiences.
Professor Bruin is also used as an expert witness in court. He says the fact that what is known about memory is relatively limited means that even the so-called memory experts must always be cautious about being too definitive.
There are large areas of human memory which are relatively unstudied, and some of these are of critical importance to these court cases. For example, memory for repeated experiences. And we think that when experiences are repeated, people abstract the common elements of a set of different experiences, but they may forget the details of individual experiences. Now, this turns out to be quite important because when you're interviewing a witness who says that a particular event has happened to him or her a number of times, they may find it difficult to recall the details associated with any one of those experiences, but they may say that they have a very good memory for the sequence of events as a whole and for what generally happened. And it's very important to bear that in mind when you're evaluating what witnesses have said in their statements.
The whole issue of expert witnesses on memory is a controversial and timely issue. The Law Commission report published just last week is recommending stricter rules on all expert witnesses, particularly in the fields of science, in part because it argues that many areas of science are not agreed, and that's clearly true in the field of memory science. But Barrister Mark Barlow, who specialised in historical child abuse cases for 16 years, says it's critical that memory experts are used more if those accused of abuse are to get a fair trial.
The reality is that when you're looking at a historical abuse case, you really do need to work extremely hard to try and get some evidence to put before the jury to actually support what your client, what the defendant is saying. And trying to reconstruct events that occurred 20, 30, 40 years ago is extremely difficult. The difficulty is at the moment is that the authorities that have decided on the point about expert evidence all say that it's only in the most exceptional circumstances that such experts will be allowed into the criminal courts, and only where there may be issues about mental health, issues concerning the complainants. So it would not be a routine, and that, in my own personal view, has got the potential of creating injustice and unfairness, and ultimately misleading the jury.
Judge Keith Cutler is a senior vice president of the Council of Circuit Judges. He believes that if expert witnesses were allowed routinely into cases, they might hinder rather than help.
We take the approach at the moment, certainly, that that evidence isn't necessarily helpful. If you started having evidence from experts to say, well, this witness cannot remember or has a false memory, then you'll have experts on the other side saying the opposite, and you'll have a trial by experts. And we cannot have this. You have 12 people there brought from all walks of life. They know about memory, what one can remember back 10, 20 years and what one can't. And if 12 of them believe that what a witness is saying is accurate and is honest and they can rely on it, then they will go forward from there. If they don't believe that that's the case, then they'll dismiss it. It's the jury who are, in many ways, the experts of memory.
It's not clear exactly how often expert witnesses are being used in these cases, but barristers we've spoken to say it's no longer exceptional. What is evident is that when they are used, in some cases, their testimony can be critical.
I would try and pretend I was asleep, lie very still in the dark, maybe thought he wouldn't be able to see me.
Jane, not her real name, says she was first abused between the age of 6 and 8. Specific details, dates and times, for example, elude her. But some things she has never been able to forget.
He would come up to the bed, lift my nightshirt and touch me between my legs, move me towards himself, unzip his trousers, and it got worse from then on, really. He would be telling me that I was a dirty girl, that it was my fault he was doing what he was doing. I was forcing him to do it. The whole episodes in themselves can only have taken matters of minutes, but for me, it felt like it was a lot longer than that. What you are aware of is the feeling of dread when my bedroom door would swing open, because I knew what was coming next. It's an awful feeling.
Jane says the abuse went on for around 4 or 5 years, but she never told anyone about it until the age of 16, when she confided in her best friend.
I can't remember what we were talking about, but it was something relevant to what my friend then said. I must have made a comment about something, and she said, well, I've been sexually abused. And the way she said it was almost like it was an aside. She obviously didn't want to make a big deal of it at all, but clearly she wanted me to know. And she said that it was at various times when he'd come to the house, I think he was babysitting. She didn't go into any detail at all about what he did. And she clearly didn't want to talk about it anymore. And it was only many, many years later that I found out that I was the first person that she'd ever told about it.
And did you ever speak about it again?
Very occasionally, but not very much at all. I was always aware that it wasn't something she liked to discuss. She's just so open about everything normally. And with this, she clearly didn't want to talk about what he did, other than to let me know that he'd done something.
But having finally mentioned it, it was to be more than 2 decades before Jane decided to try to do something about it.
When my eldest daughter got to about 7, I started to think that I really should do something, because I remember on her 7th birthday looking at her innocence. She believes in tooth fairies, Santa Claus, and beauty and love. And I looked at her and it sort of made you aware of what you were and how vulnerable at that age. And it made me very angry. And the thought that also somebody could do something to her makes me very angry.
Jane went to the police and it was decided that the case would go to court. She gave evidence for 1.5 days, something she describes as the worst experience of her life. But it was the evidence of 2 memory experts after that which was to become crucial to the case's outcome.
I was contacted by the police to tell me that the case had been dismissed. The police officer in question, who was extremely supportive, and she disclosed to me then that some experts had come forward in an issue called false memory, and that they had cast doubt. Basically, were unable to say whether I had false memory or didn't have false memory. Nobody could be sure. And as such, the judge had said that in itself would cast reasonable doubt for any jury member, and the trial therefore wasn't able to continue.
Just at that point, when you've been told the case has been thrown out because of this issue of false memory, how did you react then?
God, I went to pieces. You'd be absolutely broken. He didn't even take the stand. None of the witnesses, from my point of view, who would have supported what I said, none of those people were heard. I feel very let down by a system which didn't allow that to happen. Angry, very, very upset. And to some extent also maybe a feeling of numbness and unreality. It couldn't possibly have come to this after all that I'd gone through to get as far as I had, that it could have just fallen apart. You know, I was telling the truth. You like to believe the justice system supports those who are telling the truth, but it doesn't. What he told me as a little girl was true, that people would not believe what I said and that they would believe him. And that's what panned out. When he said they wouldn't believe me, he was right. They don't.
There are clearly huge divisions on this issue between those within both the legal and the scientific worlds. But could anything be done to change the way the system processes historical abuse cases? Should anything be done? There's division here too. Professor Martin Conway.
One solution from a legal perspective might be, rather than having trial by jury and through the adversarial system, it would be to have, for these sorts of cases, some kind of tribunal where you have an investigative judge or judges who can consult experts as they choose, who perhaps more informed on issues relating to memory and more aware of the value of particular sorts of evidence and the pitfalls of particular sorts of evidence. So I think if one took the jury out of the equation, and of course the adversarial aspect as well of the prosecution and the defence, and had a rather more, in a sense, scientific approach, inquiry approach to these cases, then I think they might be treated more precisely and perhaps more accurately.
File on 4's been told by one senior judge who didn't want to be interviewed. He also thinks it's time such cases are taken out of the hands of juries. But Circuit Judge Keith Cutler who often deals with cases involving historical allegations of abuse, fervently disagrees.
This is exactly why we have juries. It's the ideal jury case. They sit there, they listen to the evidence, they have to assess whether someone is being honest, accurate, truthful with them. And a judge is in no better special position than anybody else.
We've spoken to barristers and others within the legal system who believe that defendants aren't able to get a fair trial because very often these cases do centre almost totally around people's memories.
I don't accept that. Not only is there a high burden of proof on the prosecution to satisfy a jury that to be sure of guilt before convicting, but also the judge's summing up points out to the jury all the weaknesses of the prosecution case. That can include issues about delay, the difficulties that a defendant can have from trying to meet a case after many years, and if the jury are unsure in any way, if there is a concern because of the delay or lack of supporting evidence, then that will result in a not guilty verdict. I, for one, feel that the system is really one of the last bulwarks to ensure that defendants have a fair trial in such cases.
This is such a difficult and traumatic area for all involved. The need to get it right is obvious. At the moment, no one's even trying to assess how many of these cases are going through the courts, let alone establishing if reform is even needed. In the meantime, people on both sides, those who say they've been abused and those who claim they're wrongly accused, are left feeling justice is not being done. Again, we did want to talk to the Ministry of Justice, but no one was available for interview.